I guess we should. So today is our fifth class on Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Shinryu Suzuki. And contrary to the schedule that was posted on the website, I think there's only going to be two more weeks of this book after this. Then I'm going to give one class on an overview of the Buddhist precepts and how we hold them in our lineage. And then in March, we will start our precept study series and those classes are led by Sangha members who have received Jukai, who have formally received the precepts and become Buddhists. So every week we hear from somebody different. And except when we are at Sesshin, we will not have a class. You're definitely welcome to tune in and sit with us, but we won't be putting on a class at the same time. All right. And if you have received the precepts and you didn't see my note inviting you to sign up to teach one of the classes, let me know if you were interested. Think tonight we are on chapter, well, it's the chapter, they're not numbered. It's called The Marrow of Zen. So similarly to last time, I thought this is so short and so pithy that we would read it out loud, but not all at once. So the first section talks about this teaching of the four kinds of horses. So like last time, if I could get three volunteers, one to read the first paragraph, one to read the second, one to read the third. Oh, let's see, one, two, three, four. The first four. We will end, yeah, just the first four. So, volunteer Jinryu can do the first one. Mick can do the second. Andrew will do the third. Chris will do the fourth. Okay, go ahead.
The marrow of Zen. In the Zen posture, your mind and body have great power to accept things as they are, whether agreeable or disagreeable. In our scriptures, Samyutthagama Sutra, Volume 33, it is said that there are four kinds of horses: excellent ones, good ones, poor ones, and bad ones. The best horse will run slow and fast, right and left at the driver's will before it sees the shadow of the whip. The second best will run as well as the first one does, just before the whip reaches its skin. The third one will run when it feels pain on its body. The fourth will run after the pain penetrates to the marrow of its bones. You can imagine how difficult it is for the fourth one to learn how to run.
When we hear this story, almost all of us want to be the best horse. If it is impossible to be the best one, we want to be the second best. This is, I think, the usual understanding of this story and of Zen. You may think that when you sit in Zazen, you will find out whether you are one of the best horses or one of the worst ones. Here, however, there is a misunderstanding of Zen. If you think the aim of Zen practice is to train you to become one of the best horses, you will have a big problem. This is not the right understanding. If you practice Zen in the right way, it does not matter whether you are the best horse or the worst one. When you consider the mercy of Buddha, how do you think that Buddha will feel about the four kinds of horses? He will have more sympathy for the worst one than for the best one.
When you are determined to practice Zazen with the great mind of Buddha, you will find the worst horse is the most valuable one. In your very imperfections, you will find the basis for your firm way-seeking mind. Those who can sit perfectly physically usually take more time to obtain the true way of Zen, the actual feeling of Zen, the marrow of Zen. But those who find great difficulties in practicing Zen will find more meaning in it. So I think that sometimes the best horse may be the worst horse, and the worst horse can be the best one.
If you study calligraphy, you will find that those who are not so clever usually become the best calligraphers. Those who are very clever with their hands often encounter great difficulty after they have reached a certain stage. This is also true in art and in Zen. It is true in life. So when we talk about Zen, we cannot say he is good or he is bad in the ordinary sense of the words. The posture taken in Zazen is not the same for each of us. For some, it may be impossible to take the cross-legged posture. But even though you cannot take the right posture, when you arouse your real, way-seeking mind, you can practice Zen in its true sense. Actually, it is easier for those who have difficulties in sitting to arouse the true way-seeking mind than for those who can sit easily.
Comments or questions?
I feel better.
Yeah, I don't have a question, but when I read this, I just resonated with it so much. It felt really good. I feel like I'm the worst horse in a lot of ways, but most particularly work as an engineer. You know, I had to take many classes more than once. It took me 7 years to get my 4-year degree, and I'm struggling to get my licensure. And I told my husband, I was like, wow, like, I'm the worst horse. And I feel good about it in this moment. And he said, you're not the worst horse. And he brought up the name of somebody who I really struggle with at work, who was just like so bad and doesn't seem like he will ever get better. And it's been like a 2-year long struggle with this individual. And it really opened my heart to that individual. Mm-hmm. And that was even more meaningful than feeling good as the worst horse.
Thank you. Joan, so we can't really see the person who's speaking. Oh, that's because we moved the chair. all right. There we go.
Is that better?
Not really. It's okay.
This is the third time I've read this twice at home, and then listening to it just now, it really struck me what an integral part of this whole thing suffering is. Hmm. I mean, the worst horse is really, really trying hard, really struggling. And that's a big part of it. I don't know.
Is it or not? Tyler.
Yeah, I really like this because we didn't get to talk about mind weeds much last week, but there was some parts where they talked about when we're pulling out the weeds and then we bury them beside our back in the dirt because then they feed the plants, right? In our practice, we're going through all these hard things. And so I saw this related to the, you know, good horse, bad horse analogy, and that, you know, in our challenges, that's what really like feeds our practice. I guess I was a little thrown off though about the use of like the analogy or metaphor of like good and bad in our practice, and like one being worse and one being better, when I thought we often kind of try to dispel that sort of understanding of good or bad, or like even like that we have this sort of like improvement ladder to climb to get to this point over here, and that's good. And maybe I was reading into that that's what he was saying, but is it sort of like a, yeah, I don't know, the good versus bad was throwing me off a little bit.
Well, that was one of my questions for people was, you know, he says, if you think the aim of Zen practice is to train you to become one of the best horses, you will have a big problem, right? So he's telling us not to get trapped in the whole, you know, what does it really mean, good or bad? And yet, you know, he's using the terms and we kind of know what he's talking about. Like, what does it mean to us? What do we have in our minds about being the best horse? What would being the best horse mean in terms of, like, Zen practice?
Are you asking that?
I'm saying, what do you think of the, if you wish you're the best horse, what would
if I was the best horse, I would be meditating every day, 30 minutes a day. I would wake up with meditation. I'd be super calm and, like, very observant of what's going on. I'd never get angry. I'd never indulge in anger, never indulge in, like, greed or jealousy. You know, you just would be peaceful, like, Thich Nhat Hanh. And then my bad one is, like, my life, like, anxiety and stress and, like, trying to do this and then yelling at, you know, some kid because they, you know, threw their milk was down or I don't know, like, over stupid things. Like, your everyday life when you don't have things in order, you're not, like, calmly seeing it. Like, when you're in it and it's just like rush, 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 going crazy.
In other words, if somebody's observing you, they go, aren't you a Buddhist?
They would never, yes, exactly. That's kind of why, I feel like that's kind of why I don't say I'm a Buddhist, because I feel like they'd be like, whoa, what is wrong with you?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if this was his intention, but I kept thinking of like a racetrack, you know, and like the horses racing and how like one day one horse could win the race, you know, and everybody then bets all their money on that horse, right? But then in the next race, that horse loses. And so I just feel like it's all very relative. Like there are some days when we are the best horse, and then there's some other days where we're the absolute worst horse, but we're always the same horse in either case. So.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
For moments. Moments, you're the best horse. Moments, you're the best horse.
You think about, you know, if you come to Zen, and you're taught meditation, and you're taught the Buddha's teachings, you're taught the precepts, and you form a certain kind of aspiration to do this and to live like this. And I mean, there are people who take to it more easily than others, you know, who just somehow have some measure of self-discipline and sit every day. And when they sit, they concentrate. And they, like he was saying, some people, you know, can go down and sit in nice half straight, half lotus posture. Some people seem to really get the teachings, right? They speak up in class or they, you know, lead a class or something, and clear that they really, you know, have a good understanding of the teachings. You know, for myself, I feel like my Zazen has always been, if I evaluate it in an objective way, which I'm not supposed to do, right, but I think it's terrible. I think it's terrible, and it's always been terrible. When I first practiced, my mind was like, it was like the thoughts were going through there so fast, it literally felt like looking into a blender. It was just like, I mean, my mind didn't even wander. It was just like, and even, you know, even now, it's thinking about stuff, my mind wanders off, And so sometimes I say, you know, as it's going to come up later tonight, actually, don't evaluate your Zazen based on the result, but on the sincerity of your effort. But even then, my Zazen sucks a lot of times, right? Like, at least I can not just blame myself or get in a struggle with my mind, but I have to admit to myself that I'm sitting there just thinking about stuff because I'd like to think about stuff. So I'm not even, you know, so in that sense, I do feel like, okay, maybe not quite the worst horse, but I gotta, like, you know, unless I'm suffering, I'm not very motivated to let go of all that stuff. So I don't know. I don't know if there really are any best horses out there, but I definitely, growing up in my Sangha, I looked around and there were certainly people who looked like they were the best horse. Tyler.
Yeah, that's kind of what was striking me. Was I won't, not necessarily in Buddhism, wouldn't use this example, but like in, like with like, people often come up and when they speak like the childcare and like the style of work, they're like, you are just so patient and endlessly calm with these. And I'm like, me? I'm patient? Like, oh God. Because that's like, that's not how I view like my experience all the time. So I think that we're often like, yeah, if I were to like pick who I thought was the best horse, there's a very good chance that that horse is not like, yeah, I'm the best horse. They're probably like, no, I'm back in the pack too. Like, I'm not sure any of us, probably if you think you're the best horse, you're on the wrong track. That's the wrong, I'm mixing metaphors.
Yeah, he says something about that later on.
Yeah.
He says, like, if you think you're good, yeah. Zach.
Yeah, I think there's also a level of it where if this person does exist, that, you know, they found Zen and they sat down and their mind was perfectly calm and it was easy for them to do. If that person's real, then doing it every day is not a challenge for them. It's not like they can just come in and do it and they wouldn't bat an eye. My knees hurt every time I sit down and it's a struggle to do it, but I have to like push myself to do it. Right. And when we do that, it is a reflection on what it means to us and why we're prioritizing it. Where you don't necessarily see that if, again, this imaginary person exists.
Well, and it raises the whole question of what are we doing this for? Because he says, if you think the aim of Zen practice is to train you to become one of the best horses, you will have a big problem. So like, what is this about? Because an effort is required, right? If this horse analogy is about us trying to, you know, sit Zazen, keep the precepts, let go of attachment to self, whatever other things you can put under practice. I mean, it is the point of practice for us to work on those things, but to become the, you know, so what is the aim of it if not this? If it's not to become the best horse, what is the effort? What is the point?
Yeah, I hate this chair. So briefly, I think the point is to steady the mind.
Sorry, Mick, you might have had something else you were going to say. I don't know if you...
No, that was it. That's why I didn't want
to share. It's just... I like this chapter in particular because it feels kind of like a pep talk in the middle of like, this is not the way. And then all of a sudden he's just kind of like, look, it's hard. And like, the idea is that like, for me, this chapter is about your commitment to not being attached to results. I mean, I think a lot of times my particular nature, I'm like a hugely competitive person. I'm like looking around, I'm like, am I doing it right? Am I doing it better than this person or better than that person? Or looks like they got this. And And I think, like, to me, this chapter was like, that's like not what we're doing here. And he even mentions this like much later in the book. This was like the highlighted part of the whole book for me. It's later in a chapter called Mistakes in Practice. He says, when we practice Zazen, we just practice it. And whether we find joy in our practice or not, we just do it. And I just, I don't know, man. I that resonated with me because it's just like, it's just about the effort. Don't worry about anything else.
No, Jinryu.
You know, I got to thinking about this last sentence of the fourth paragraph, and I really resonated with this sentence and with what Chris had to say, and it put me in mind of playing golf. And I was a terrible golfer. I played for 10 years. Terrible. I just couldn't get the swing. Every now and then I'd get a great shot and it would go high and it would go long and I would keep coming back for that. It hurt my body because my idea was the important point was to hit the fool out of that ball, which if anybody knows anything about golf, that is not the point. And so it would hurt my shoulder and my elbow and the whole bit. But, and I don't play anymore. I haven't played for years. But when I look back on that, the beauty of it for me was the experience. Sustainability aside, because I know that's a whole new issue, but golf courses are beautiful. Especially in the evening when no one is around and the animals come out. And you're just, it's like whoever said it, it's like a walk in the park. And I have very fond memories of that. And so I think what I'm getting out of that, especially the part about the way-seeking mind, really comes out when you keep trying. And I totally get trying with pain. But it's for me, it's really about the experience. I do it because that's what I'm supposed to do. And I just keep coming back. That's my thought.
Thank you. Linda.
Well, it looks like my video's not working, but can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. what came to mind for me, and I can totally relate to what Jinryu said about golf, because my husband has been golfing since he was probably 5 or 6 years old. And I've just been taking lessons recently, and I have to let go of trying to get a good score and that being the most important thing, and just accepting what I can do and enjoying the surroundings and enjoying the people I'm with. And also practicing. And I'm thinking about Zazen as maybe coming to sit with yourself as you are. Every time you sit, rather than trying to be something because of it, I guess, just starting fresh every time and just being with yourself as you are. It's not like doing push-ups, trying to, you know, do more push-ups every time. That's how I look at it.
Thank you. You remind me too of my example was excuse me, taking Aikido for a while, and I was really clear when you're in that kind of art that you know, you don't walk in there and like there's a beginner and you go, psh, you're just a beginner. You don't like the practice of a beginner, the practice somebody in the middle, the practice of a master are all completely equally. I mean, what's the point? There's, you know, the point is how much are you engaging it? How wholeheartedly, how much are you learning? How much you were getting out of the experience? Justin?
I really like the horse. I really resonate with the horse metaphor. I think because my mom works with horses and loves horses and grew up with horses, and I have this image of like horses. She grew up in the country, like rural Canada, and these horses kind of like running free, like not for a race, and just like the beauty of like a horse that just runs because it wants to run. Mm-hmm. And when I think of like this image that is given in the book, it's like there's these horses and they're at a track and they're racing almost out of fear or conditioning and like an impulsive grasping of like, need to go, need to go, need to go. And I think this, like, the horse that is the worst at that or struggles at that is the most likely to look around and be like, wait, why am I even running right now? And so like, to me, if there is a purpose about Zen, it's like that I can be that horse in the meadow. Mm-hmm. I don't need to race around and around the track. And so I really like this image that he gives because it just, for me, it just really clicked. So.
Thank you. That kind of brings me to that question of like, so why would it actually be advantageous to be the worst horse sometimes? Or also, as he says, it is easier for those who have difficulties in sitting to arouse the true way-seeking mind than for those who can sit easily. Where would this actually be a benefit as opposed to like, oh, well, no good or bad, you know, just kind of make no distinctions. Or where our challenges might actually be beneficial. Jen.
I was just thinking that maybe if you, if it's easier for you to do things that other people tell you to do and just accept things, then maybe you're not really finding yourself. You're not engaging with your own questions.
Linda?
Yeah, I was thinking of something similar to what was just said. If you're struggling, then it might bring you to looking at things in your life that are causing suffering and how you might be able to contemplate those in a different way to reduce the suffering. You might be looking deep within and recognizing your challenges.
Thank you. Chris?
It seems to me that it goes back to the comment made earlier too, that suffering is just so built into the whole thing. And when you are struggling with sitting, if you're just simply struggling with the posture, you're right up against the acute friction of suffering. And so you're right there at that first noble truth and at, you know, the first rung of the ladder, so to speak. The ladder, of course, that doesn't go anywhere, that doesn't go up or down or anything.
Yeah. And then you had the flip side too of saying if like you're actually kind of skilled or talented or whatever, you can actually have greater difficulty at a certain point. Why would that be? I think practice, as well as these other kind of complex endeavors, you know, these arts, these disciplines, sports, whatever, they're not something that our small self can like master with there's something more that goes on, right? There's a small self that we kind of learn and try. It's that will can take us a certain distance, but then the real art involves kind of letting go. It's the small self is not responsible for that. So if you're somebody who like stuff doesn't really come easily or naturally, you're unlikely to get quite as fixated on that small self's achievement, right? Because you're kind of from the beginning, you're like, I gotta kind of wing it here. But if you are kind of good at it, then you can become attached to that and limited to it and actually get stuck in the practice. And when it's more difficult, we have to arouse greater determination. We have to do it from the very beginning. We have to do it for a reason other than looking like the best horse, right? From the beginning, we're not getting the rewards, or we're not looking like we think, we're not achieving what we think we're supposed to be. So from the beginning, we're just like, I don't really get this. I don't know, I'm just showing up. just actually closer to the true spirit of it, right? That's something that we try to perfect. So how about we read a little bit from the next section? So I figure we do two more paragraphs about mistakes. So one is, we'll start from when we reflect on, and then the second one, volunteers for these two. John for the first one, and Erica for the second. So starting with when we reflect on what we are doing in our everyday life.
When we reflect on what we are doing in our everyday life, we are always ashamed of ourselves. One of my students wrote to me saying, "You sent me a calendar, and I am trying to follow the good mottos which appear on each page. But the year has hardly begun, and already I have failed." Dogen Zenji said, "Soshaku jashaku. Shaku generally means mistake or wrong. Soshaku jushaku means to succeed wrong with wrong, or one continuous mistake. According to Dogen, one continuous mistake can also be Zen. A Zen master's life could be said to be so many years of soshaku jashaku. This means so many years of one single-minded effort."
We say a good father is not a good father. Do you understand? One who thinks he is a good father is not a good father. One who thinks he is a good husband is not a good husband. One who thinks he is one of the worst husbands may be a good one if he is always trying to be a good husband with a single-hearted effort. If you find it impossible to sit because of some pain or some physical difficulty, then you should sit anyway, using a thick cushion or a chair. Even though you are the worst horse, you will get to the marrow of Zen.
Comments or questions about one continuous mistake? Dogen has a whole fascicle on that titled "One Continuous Mistake." Or just, I like the more like succeed wrong with wrong. It's like continuous mistakes, not one mistake. It's lots of mistakes. Andrew.
Just a quick comment. Erica, when we were covering the first three paragraphs that we read, mentioned something about good horse and bad horse being relative. And then what was said in, I think, the second paragraph of this reading about if you think that you're the best dad, you might not be, and so on. Is it not only, I certainly don't think that objective comes in here, and relative does, but it's also, what about subjective? I mean, like, if, you know, the subjective experience of, oh, I'm the best in the room, or also on the other side, the subjective experience of I'm the worst in the room. And how does that, and how does that manifest, and how does that cause suffering for not only ourselves, but for others, when we're having the subjective experience of being either the best horse or the worst horse?
I think the joy of it is that we're always wrong if we're thinking either of those things.
The ideal of the expectation meets the reality.
Yes, indeed. Like, that is some crazy narrative that, I mean, I, in particular, those of us who suffer from arrogance also suffer usually from, and we may hide it, but we also suffer from, like, devastatingly low self-esteem, and it's just bouncing back and forth, because basically it's this, like, it's the same thing. It's just sometimes you're up and sometimes you're down, and it's like, at some point, when this is what's so great about practice, because we become more aware of this crap that's going on in our head, and the idea that, like, I am the worst. I am just, of all the people at the Zen Center, I'm the most unlikable. I'm the one that doesn't get it. I'm the one with the terrible meditation, whatever it is.
I don't understand the teachings.
It's like, it's just ridiculous. It's like, it's crazy self-ego aggrandizement. It's like, no, of course not. Of course you're not. So there's this kind of, I don't know, that's part of liberation in practice, is when we, and one of my Zen Dharma sisters called it joining the human race. Once we just kind of set all those divisive narratives aside, and just, like, we're really just, generally speaking, no better horse than anybody else, which means letting go of these ideals, but also just giving ourselves a break. I don't know if that addresses what you're talking about. Yeah, Karen. Nope, you're still muted.
Yeah. Where he's talking about being a good, I guess, a good father, or one who thinks he's a good father is not a good father. Well, if I turn that to being a good mother or a good wife, because that would be my relationship with marriage and my children. I'm a naturally very patient, compassionate person. And what brought me to Zen is, even having those qualities in my life, it wasn't helping me when my marriage was falling apart, and I've talked about this a lot, that I have a son with addiction, and I just needed something more. I needed a different way to look at life and look at my relationships, and basically for my own survival, I needed something, you know, deeper to just to help me through those really difficult times. And so I guess I relate to that, because most people would look at me and think, oh, you're such a great mom. And I actually still hear that today. Oh, you're just such an amazing mom. And not so much about being a wife, but really an amazing mom. And yet it has taken so much work to separate myself from my son's addiction, you know, to let go of things, and actually what I really have been, what's so nice is to see him in a different light, you know, to see him more than just a person with an addiction. And that's, you know, in the earlier paragraphs, talking about the best horse or the worst horse or whatever, you know, if I didn't have those difficulties in my life, I know I wouldn't be here, because I wouldn't need it. I wouldn't have You actually, Domio, I think last Sunday, used the term living an examined life. And I actually wrote that down because I have, you know, a lot of people, I'm kind of quiet about studying Buddhism because people are like, doing what? And I really like that. It's kind of succinct. It's like, you know, I'm just living an examined life. I just want to look at myself, look at my thoughts, the way I see the world, and, you know, just have a greater acceptance of, you know, things around me. And I truly believe it's only because I've had, you know, gone through these difficulties in my life that even brought me here. That's it.
Well, there's the, you know, there's the Buddhist cosmology of the six realms, which you don't have to believe literally, but, you know, they say if you're in the heaven realm, nobody practices in the heaven realm. Why would they, you know? But, and if it's too, you know, in the hell realm and difficult realm, it can be too difficult to practice, right? There's, you just don't have your basic needs met, but you're just the right amount of suffering, you know? It can motivate us to practice, and yet we still have some energy left for practice. And when you think about it, like, you can't make a mistake unless you have some kind of aspiration. You know, if you just, you know, went with the flow and who cares, there are no mistakes. If you're not trying to do anything, there are no mistakes. So it's like those mistakes are, they're part and parcel with wanting to be a good mother or a good wife or, you know, a good person or to examine our life or whatever it is that we're aspiring to. It's like, no matter how good we are, I mean, we could be as close to that perfect horse as we can imagine, and we will fall short countless times every day because that's just the nature of life, right? And just to some extent, that I think is a, it's something that if we can really come to terms with over the course of our lives, of the course of our practice, when we realize there's no resting place. There's no point at which this is all going to be resolved. There's no point at which we're going to like, yeah, I got this now. Our aspiration is just, our lives are just going to be one mistake after another. But that doesn't have to be a bad thing. You know, that can be, if we just accept it, that is the way that our lives are, that we're not going to reach some perfection, then it's a good thing. Then it's a sign that we're living with aspiration, that we're, you know, we're like, what did he say, like the bad husband who's, you know, trying wholeheartedly to be good. John.
Yeah, on the first paragraph, when we were talking about doing wrongs, I kind of started off thinking you're not supposed to judge yourself, that kind of stuff. So it's just your mind judging yourself. But when Dogen Zenji basically comes up with a saying, so I pay a little bit more attention to it. It's like, and basically at the start of today's thing, I don't have it in front of me, so I can't quote it exactly. But basically, if you're off by a hair's breadth, it's the difference between heaven and hell. So basically, we're all wrong most of the time, is basically what he's saying. I mean, the process of all these people, you know, in our past learning this stuff, they do have one wrong after another. You just keep going till you get it perfect, right? So keep going. And then in the second one, you know, I was a little bit taken back, you know, someone who thinks they're a good father isn't a good father, or thinks they're a good husband isn't a good husband. So he had to peel the layers on that. Basically, I guess what he's saying is, if you think you're good, you're not trying anymore. So in other words, keep going. Mm-hmm. If you're judging yourself as good, the whole point is to keep going, keep trying to be the best. So basically both paragraphs to me are basically keep going. So.
Yeah. I mean, and I think there's a way that we could, you know, kind of realistically evaluate ourselves and say, all things considered, I've been a pretty good, spouse or student or daughter, parent or something. So there's a certain kind of objective evaluation we can come up with, comparing ourselves to others or to expectations or something. But I think that it really is more of that sense of not, like, no longer trying to grow or aspire. You know, if I was just like, I'm a good wife, and the way that I communicate and the way that I move around the kitchen and the way that I deal with things doesn't need changing. just would not reflect reality, right? I would no longer be receptive and growing. Well, there is a little part at the end here, which was so, so powerful. Suppose your children are suffering from a hopeless disease. You do not know what to do. You cannot lie in bed. Normally, the most comfortable place for you would be a warm, comfortable bed, but now, because of your mental agony, you cannot rest. You may walk up and down, in and out, but this does not help. Actually, the best way to relieve your mental suffering is to sit in Zazen. Even in such a confused state of mind and bad posture. If you have no experience of sitting in this kind of difficult situation, you are not a Zen student. No other activity will appease your suffering. In other restless positions, you have no power to accept your difficulties. But in the Zazen posture, which you have acquired by long, hard practice, your mind and body have great power to accept things as they are, whether they are agreeable or disagreeable. A few minutes, and know whether anybody was willing to share something of their experience of this, how it is that accepting things as they are appeases suffering even when our difficulties persist. Mark.
I was waiting for this paragraph and a bit of a testimonial that also brings in earlier paragraphs about confronting a challenge can give you an opportunity to be more wholehearted. I tried for years, first of all, to sit up straight with absolutely no success, and a teacher at the Rohatsu Sesshin a little over a year ago told me, use support, make yourself comfortable. So I did. But the other problem I had was being able to stay awake, literally falling asleep every minute. Got a CPAP machine. I knew I had apnea. It just didn't bother me, except the fact that I would sleep through the whole Sesshin. So it didn't help. Yeah, I'm sleeping really much better, but during the day, fall asleep. I fall asleep when I'm weaving sometimes. So I went to another doctor and he said, you have narcolepsy and I have a pill that will change your life. So this year, when I went to Rohatsu Sesshin, I just had the pill. I couldn't be awake for the whole thing because even the maximum dose wouldn't do it for me. But for about 5 hours a day, I could actually be awake. And that just sent me into practice more wholehearted than ever. Now when I practice, I don't just practice. I prostrations, chanting, recitations, three refuges, four vows, five remembrances, all that stuff. And then I sit for 2 hours straight. And that's the first part. So that's like, that's that challenge, surmounting that challenge did just supercharge my practice. The other thing is, what I get to when I practice, and I haven't heard anybody talk about this, is by starting with relaxing my body, just feeling relaxed on the cushion with the back support. I find that that relaxes my mind to the extent that I can accept anything that happens. A few days ago, my son has a painting business, and ladders are stored against the wall of the house that's where my bedroom is. And I was sitting and, you know, feeling really relaxed, and they were clanging ladders to move them around and adjust and put this one behind and that one in front for about 20 minutes, banging, shaking the house. And I didn't care. I was perfectly alert to the sound, and I just didn't care. So I like, but, he says it had to be hard practice of, you know, submitting to the pain. For me, it was not so much hard practice, but finding a way to be relaxed and confident that I could be awake.
Thank you for sharing. That brings us almost up to the end. Like that. Like that image of you sitting calmly with the banging ladders. There is, you know, in case anyone here is unfamiliar, you know, we make a distinction in Buddhism between pain and suffering. So pain, physical pain, emotional pain, mental pain, whatever. Our practice sometimes does alleviate some of the pain, but most of the time it doesn't. Pain can be dealt with. It can be endured. We can even scream about it. We can cry. And there's a, and I think most of you have had this experience at some point. It, especially like grief, for the loss of someone or something that, you know, doesn't have a lot of sticky karma associated with it. It's just a pure pain. It's just pain. It's not that big a deal. But we usually make this a lot worse, right? It's our response to the pain. It's our worry. It's our catastrophizing. It's our, what does this mean about me? It's, you know, all of that extra stuff is what tends to make it unbearable, and also kind of it doesn't tend to like move and progress, right? It just kind of tends to stay stuck. So when we can accept, because he says when you are sitting in the middle of your own problem, which is more real to you, your problem or you yourself? The awareness that you are here right now is the ultimate fact. So when we can, and it could be in Zazen, but like even just a moment of mindfulness of just what is, this is the only thing that is real. This moment is the only reality there is. Now it's our narratives about our life, our evaluations, our plans, our hopes, our fears, they may have some validity and we may need to pick them back up again, right? That's how we navigate our life. But, you know, in this moment, they don't apply. In this moment, we are free. All of those stories are, they're just stories. So, I mean, not to put it in opposition, right? It's not to say all of that is false per se, but if we can rest in that, this moment with just not trying to fight anything that is. It's not like necessarily that you're gonna feel great or calm or something, but I think just a little bit more sane, you know, just a little bit better able to just keep it together and go on. So yeah, I back up what he recommends in that passage. All right. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for coming.